Support for The Best of Our Knowledge comes from the College of St. Rose in Albany, offering master's and certificate programs for working adults looking to advance or change their careers. Easily accessible to downtown and state offices, the College of St. Rose has served the Capital District since 1920. strose.edu/grad programs to apply.
This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
You know what almost never happens anymore here in the good old USA? A unanimous Supreme Court decision, that's what. But last week, that's just what happened. The court ruled that school districts are required to give students with disabilities more than just the bare minimum education.
To me, it shifts the position of the school district from one that must satisfy a minimum standard to one that must offer reasonable hope of progress.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to a special education expert about this decision and what it may mean for students with disabilities, from minor learning disorders to children on the autism spectrum. We'll also spend an academic minute helping students who may have had a concussion. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. On Wednesday, March 22nd, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 8-0 in a case called Andrew F. v. Douglas County School District. The decision was seen as a victory for students across the country with disabilities and in special education. Here to talk about that decision, as well as special education in general and students with autism in particular, is Dr. John McLaughlin, Executive Vice President and Director of Research and Analytics for ChanceLight Behavioral Health, Therapy, and Education. 40 years ago, he founded Benton Hall Academy in Nashville, which specializes in special education. I spoke to Dr. McLaughlin a few days after the Andrew F. ruling came down, and I asked what this means for schools and students.
Well, it is a decision that is very good for kids. It was straightening out a 1982 decision that public education has had in place or has used as the guidance since that time that really dealt with how aggressively a public school district needs to be for writing an individualized education plan for kids in special education. It was called the Rowley decision. And that decision never made clear an important point, which the Andrew F. decision does make clear. And the clarity point, Bob, was that school districts are now asked to make an IEP that sets as a goal reasonable progress for a child based upon the child's individual circumstances. Prior to that, the Rowley decision said that special education had to provide a de minimis or a minimal amount of effort to move a child forward. It was called a floor program. You didn't have to provide a ceiling. You don't know how far children can go necessarily. But you were okay within the law by providing a floor of opportunity. This pushes further the expectation of a public school district to reach toward greater expectation for a child. To me, it shifts the position of the school district from one that must satisfy a minimum standard to one that must offer reasonable hope of progress. That's what this decision does.
It's still kind of ambiguous, though, right?
Well, it is ambiguous. The Supreme Court did not set standards like one grade level of progress or 1 year of progress per grade level. That's the mainstream standard. When a child is in third grade, we expect them to make enough progress to go to fourth grade and from fourth grade to fifth grade. But special education isn't like that. It doesn't have the capacity to set specific behavioral or academic goals. It's individually crafted to the handicapping needs of the children. And most of the children that the Andrew F. case will affect are children who are on the more severe end of the special education world. This isn't a great change for children who have a reading disability or any other type of academic learning disability. This is much more for children on a more severe end and what we're expecting. It's not just a maintenance program. It's a program that we will expect growth and progress. So there is softness in the decision, Bob. It's not letter specific as to what must happen. It just shifts the burden or the emphasis toward let's make progress. Let's write IEPs that are reasonable expectations considering the child's circumstances. Before that, it didn't have to be. We didn't have to create growth goals. We didn't have to put things that we expected children to do. we just had to maintain. And that's not to take away or to say that special educators don't care about their kids. They genuinely do care about their kids. They go into the business to help children with handicapping conditions. But case after case, when families go to the mat, so to speak, and wrestling on an IEP because they want more for their child, the districts have been able to say, well, we're not required to give you more. We're required to give you the Rowley level of service. Now that level of service goes up in the Andrew F. case.
And this is going to go district by district, state by state. How will this be rolled out?
Well, it's a federal law, so it protects all children with handicapping conditions, all children in the special education world and public education. But special education, that's, you know, it's in its 40th year of implementation here in 2017. It's still very different state to state. That's part of the beauty of our 10th Amendment, our Constitution, but it's also part of the complexity of special education as well. What passes for special education programming in some states would not pass muster in other states. We have some very aggressive states on special education that keep up with research and have high expectations. And then we have some states, Bob, that don't do very much. They're pretty relaxed about special education. So it's going to be, the last ruling stood for 35 years. This isn't going to be an overnight change in special education. It will take not just years, but many years to kind of feather out how Andrew F. is applied. What is the new standard? What the courts, when it's challenged in lower courts and in special education due process hearings, what the decisions are going to be until we begin to create a body of experience that guides us. That's the way this work and this law and this profession is shaped.
It seems to me that, and this is the last question I'll ask on this topic, is that this could cause a lot more cases, a lot more parents saying, no, no, you have to give me more. And the school district saying, well, we are giving you more, that type of thing. Do you see that happening?
Well, I don't think this is going to stop parents from litigating or going through the due process administrative hearings that are in place for special education. But it does give the guidance officers, the hearing officers, or the judge a standard to apply. Now, that standard may vary case to case, state to state, district to district. But it is guidance. It will help. I don't think, though, Bob, it's going to create a storm of legal challenges. I think this was the legal challenge. This case bubbled up for years, and many cases before it create this type of case law that shapes this case law, and then finally Supreme Court decision that shapes the special education world. So there's not going to be a torrent of activity as a result. Teachers, special education directors, superintendents, parents are all going to take this into account and look at the IEP and I hope act accordingly.
Your book, your latest book, of course, is called How Autism is Reshaping Special Education. A question I like to ask all the time of people, do you think we're seeing a lot more autism, or are we just getting better at seeing autism and diagnosing it?
Well, we're certainly seeing a lot more, and it is part of it as we're getting better at diagnosing it. We're much more tuned into autism than we were 15 years ago. I've been involved with special education since the early 1970s, and at that point, we labeled children, or the autism prevalence was about 1 in 10,000 children. Today, it's about 1 in 64. Part of that is an increase in the numbers, but part of it also, Bob, is a shifting of the diagnosis of autism. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual number 5 that came out several years ago put a larger umbrella over autism, or it widened the net of how children that could be diagnosed as having autism. So that is part of the reason we see more children with autism. We also see, not exactly on a one-to-one ratio, but we see less children now with diagnosis of developmental disability or other types of classifications that a decade or so ago the children would have been more apt to get. Today, that same behavior or that same clinical presentation is more likely to get an autism diagnosis. At the same time, we do have more children born with exceptionalities, even though we're holding the special education population around 13% of our 55 million kids in the K-12 age range. More of them are shifting out of learning disabilities into autism. Autism is the fourth largest disability inside of special education, but it only contains about 8% of children in special education. So we see an awful lot of it, and for a diagnosis that's the fourth largest in really only 8% of special education kids, it really does dominate the news, and it really has dominated the news for the last 10 years or so.
The Individuals with Disability Education Act is coming up for reauthorization in some years, in 2020. Could you just give us a quick outline of what that act did and what might happen to it now?
The Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, also called IDEA, is the current law, or the current name for the law, that started in 1975, called Public Law 94-142, the Education of All Handicapped Children Act. Gerald Ford signed it in November of 75. It went into effect in October of 77. And it is reauthorized and relabeled in its authorization sometimes. So that's the history. That's where it comes from, 40 years old. IDEA is an effort to accommodate the needs of special needs children, special education kids, kids with handicapping conditions inside of public education. It was last reauthorized in 2004. It is the guidebook. It is the rule book on how children with special education should be identified, how when parents have a concern about special education, they go to the school district and request an evaluation, for instance, and how the school district must respond, and timelines around all of these processes. It is last authorized in 2004, and it should be authorized every 10 years, so we are past due. I think it took us 16 or 17 years to upgrade No Child Left Behind, or to reauthorize it. It was from 2001 until end of 2015, so that was a 14-year gap. So going beyond 10 years is not unusual in our process. We think it should be reauthorized in sometime in the next several years. There are groups getting ready for it, but there's no official date or process set at this time. I think it's going to be a really interesting reauthorization process, Bob. In 2004, it was reauthorized, and though there were changes made, I don't think there were any challenges to the law or to its administration like we're going to see in its next reauthorization. The world has changed substantially. Special education and particularly disability advocacy has changed dramatically in this period of time, and that will come to bear in its reauthorization. Parents are much more organized, much more vocal. A different generation of parents are now advocating for their children than those who created the law 40 years ago and who have shepherded it in this four-decade period. And this is brought on, in my opinion, by the rise of social media, the ability of families to link around common cause, ability of people, not just families, but anybody to link through social media to interest groups, whether it's fly fishing or whether it's autism. It creates a mechanism for the exchange of ideas and the quick dissemination of a thought or a study or a notion. And that has dramatically changed the nature of advocacy, and it will impact the rewrite of IDEA.
You have an administration and a Congress that is very anti-federal government getting into education matters. Do you think that'll affect what's about to happen?
Well, that's a great question, and it's a big unknown. We're all speculating what the change in Washington and the White House and in the Congress will do to education and to our nation in general. Early indications are beginning to come out, though. I mean, the skinny budget that was released not very many days ago showed a 9% decrease, a $13 billion cut to the U.S. Department of Education. That's serious. It has about a $68, $70 billion budget, and about $13 billion would be removed if the president has total say in that. At the same time, Bob, nothing was taken out of the special education budget. It got its allotment as it had last year's budget. So special education wasn't targeted, but general or the overall structure of the Department of Education was targeted. The other thing that's gaining a lot of attention is the new Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos. She is definitely a champion of choice. She is not through the ranks educator that has led a State Department of Education or a major school district. And her interaction with public education is as one who is from the outside and not grown up in it. So I think that's going to be, it's an unknown, but we need to give her time and need to wish her the best. She has a large job, and our nation's children and our nation's school systems depend greatly upon her leadership right now. The other thing that is a real chip on the table is the fact that the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which was passed in 65 under LBJ and like other programs, goes forward and is reauthorized every 10 years or so, was reauthorized. It was No Child Left Behind. And in late 2015, December, Senator Lamar Alexander, Republican, and Democrat Patty Murray from Washington State really did a masterful job of getting a new federal bill on public K-12 education through Congress and through the Senate called and named Every Student Succeeds Act. It was quite a bit of celebration at the end of 2015 and then 2016 on that accomplishment, but that was pretty much dismantled a couple of weeks ago by this Congress, and we don't know what is going to replace it. There's a great deal of uncertainty right now in the politics of K-12 education, and school districts and State Department of Education really are wondering what to do and wondering where to turn for answers right now. It's quite a time in public education.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. John McLaughlin continues with a look at applied behavior analysis and how it's being used for special education. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. John McLaughlin, Executive Vice President and Director of Research and Analytics for Chance Light Behavioral Health, Therapy, and Education. Before I ended our conversation, I wanted to talk to Dr. McLaughlin about a topic we touched on recently in our shows on autism, applied behavior analysis.
Well, applied behavioral analysis, or ABA, is the most researched and documented treatment for children with autism to make progress. And it's not just for children with autism. It's children for a wide variety of developmental disabilities. And really, in its application, Bob, it's for anyone that wants to change a behavior or make progress with themselves. So ABA is a much broader science than just a science that applies to kids with autism, though it is very, very associated with autism now. Applied behavioral analysis comes out of psychology. It came from a gentleman named Ivor Lovaas, who was a professor at UCLA in the 1960s and 70s. He did his seminal work on using this method of stimulus in response. That's not exactly, it's really observing behavior, what is an antecedent behavior, like a loud noise and a reaction from, say, a child with autism of dramatic screaming and fear, and how a therapist, a behavior analyst, can create an environment where the child can either grow used to a loud noise without that type of behavior, or a parent can do the same so that a siren going by a house does not become a traumatic event for a child, or a barking dog, or the smell of perfume, or things that can set children with autism or other sensory disabilities off. And that is applied behavioral analysis. It's a great treatment. It needs to be applied intensively. The younger the child is when he or she would begin treatment, the better, and the better outcomes that can be created for the child. But that's what applied behavioral analysis is. It's a relatively new profession. We have only about 20,000 behavior analysts in the country right now. They are recognized by most insurance companies as a therapy or a therapist that can be reimbursed for providing the behavioral health benefit of applied behavioral analysis. And that is driving the growth of the industry. There are far fewer people than are needed within school districts and within behavioral clinics and as private practitioners in the area to help kids with autism and other developmental disabilities. It's recognized in about half the states as a licensed area, something that's licensed. Florida kind of grabbed it early, Bob, in the 80s and 90s, and really developed it more as a discipline and as a profession than any other state. I think Florida still has the highest number of BCBAs per population. But it's not, I don't think Florida licensed BCBAs, ironically. I think that's just a little irony inside of the world of behavior analysis. But it is a very definite, specific science that has, if you will, won the day of research. It organized itself early. It created journals. It created mechanisms for publication, for the review of work, for the science and the publication of that science to advance. And that has put it in the catbird seat, if you will, in terms of treatment for children with autism. School districts still don't have as many of these people as they would like, and it's tough for school districts to grab them and hold them and to utilize applied behavioral analysis in a way that fits the model of special education and the model of organization of schools. But there's progress being made around the country. I think Vermont is very good at utilizing behavior analysts. I think Utah is extremely good at utilizing behavior analysts, things that we discuss in our book.
Dr. John McLaughlin is Executive Vice President and Director of Research and Analytics for ChanceLight Behavioral Health, Therapy, and Education. His new book, written with Mark Claypool, is called How Autism is Reshaping Special Education, The Unbundling of IDEA. Student athletes are always in danger of suffering a concussion, but they're not the only ones. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Concussions are becoming a serious medical issue in athletics. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Susan Davies, associate professor of school psychology at the University of Dayton, explores these injuries off the field and in the classroom.
We've all heard about football players who have sustained concussions. However, it's not just our athletes who are at risk. Children of all ages have high incidence rates of concussions through recreational activities, falls, accidents, and abuse. These brain injuries can result in a cluster of physical, cognitive, emotional, and sleep-related symptoms. While injured athletes often receive treatment in a sports concussion clinic and may be monitored by an athletic trainer, many students receive little guidance on how to safely resume physical and cognitive activity. An elementary student who sustained a concussion after falling off her bike may return to school while still experiencing symptoms. Because concussion symptoms are invisible, her teacher will likely expect her to engage in all of the typical classroom activities, which can worsen symptoms and prolong recovery. In my work, I train teachers, school psychologists, school nurses, administrators, and others on how to help children who have sustained concussions return to the classroom safely. I researched a team-based model to help educators recognize and respond to concussions. It starts with a team leader, such as the school nurse or school psychologist, who gathers injury reports, facilitates communication among the family and team members, and helps manage the child's return to school. The team helps develop a plan of symptom-based accommodations, such as shortened assignments, rest periods throughout the day, and wearing sunglasses to decrease light sensitivity. These are gradually withdrawn as the student recovers. With a team in place to listen and work towards solutions, students of all ages can receive appropriate academic and environmental adjustments and be better monitored for a safe return to activity.
That was Susan Davies of the University of Dayton. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the American Association of Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.